And welcome, 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 dear listeners. Obviously, waking you up a little bit there in terms of, yes, we've got a little tangy, sweet, lovely, I must say sexy, jingle going there for our Sunday morning sessions. But once again, just saying a good morning once again. You're on your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday morning take. You're in my company from 5 to 7 a.m. And obviously sort of like helping us into, you know, sort of like this first 10 minutes of this morning show. You heard a little bit there of some lovely music coming through right there. However, we're going to step into some more music, but just once again welcoming you. Just to let you know that if you've just woken up and you're just in our company in terms of starting off your day, good morning. I do hope that you've got a cup of coffee, you know, in close proximity to you. I'm not promoting coffee, just, you know, well, probably a little bit in terms of just citing, you know, that, it's also my poison of choice, you know, in terms of morning and waking up in the mornings. However, obviously, yeah, if you're not a coffee drinker, there's always, water. There's always water. But on that particular note, dear listeners, we're quickly turning back to the music and coming back right after this very short musical break in terms of getting into our discussion for this morning. And obviously, as we always do, we lead you into the rest of your Sunday morning programming here on your number one talk radio station, which obviously will come in after 7 a.m. In the meantime, you're in my company and we'll obviously be getting into our conversation pretty shortly.
Arabella's got some interstellar gator skin boots. And a helter-skelter and a little finger, and I ride it endlessly. She's got a Barbarella silver swimsuit, and when she needs to shelter from reality, she takes a dip in my daydream. My days am best when the sunset gets itself behind that little lady sitting on the passing side. It's much less picturesque without her catching the light. The horizon tries, but it's just not as kind on the eye. Arabella's got a seven seas head, but she's a modern lover, it's an exploration. She's made of outer space, and her lips are like the galaxy's edge, and a kiss the color of a constellation falling into place. My days am best when the sunset gets itself behind that little lady sitting on the passing side. It's much less picturesque without her catching the light. The horizon tries, but it's just not as kind on the eye. Just might have tapped into your mind.
And coming back there from the sounds of the Arctic Monkeys with the song Arabella, this was probably the last time that they had a pretty good album themselves, because since then things have not been as uplifting for a fan like myself to listen to. But nonetheless, dear listeners, that's me just going off on a little bit of a tangent there. You know, just in terms of being a musical connoisseur myself. But yeah, welcoming you obviously in earnest there from on the back of the sounds there of the Arctic Monkeys, in terms of them coming, bringing us, or sort of like introducing us into this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take. Obviously, as we start off, in terms of what we always do here on my Sunday Morning's Take, is that we take a look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, to help understand ultimately what's going on around us in terms of, you know, the world of the developments itself. We step into a particular realm that helps us explain to great length, dear listeners. And I, to be honest, I also have a little bit of a confession to make. I actually thought that most of this particular drama that we've been experiencing for the past 2 years, technically for the past 70 plus years since 1945, has been drama that actually began in 1945. No. It always brings us back, unfortunately, to the First World War. And unfortunately, it brings us back to similarities of things that even happened, that even sealed the fate of a territory like Namibia itself after the First World War, after the madness of the First World War. And they thought that the First World War would be the only particular said global war. No. Our discussion today, dear listeners, obviously is born on the back of even our president, as she delivered her particular speech there at the UN General Assembly this past week, and many other particular leaders of the Global South stepped up and in some way or form reiterated the same things that she also cited, specifically the solidarity for, you know, the Palestinians, the particular end to the, you know, not so nice violence that is persisting in that same neighborhood there, specifically of the territory of Israel and specifically the disputed areas where the Palestinians live. Now, obviously, if you look at the position that Namibia has, we are asking specifically for a peaceful end to these particular hostilities, and that people technically get back to the negotiation table, talk to each other, and engage with each other in a more humane manner, ultimately using language. Now, not just using language, but also, engaging in the art of negotiations and specifically trying to find the common ground between each other. And obviously, as you would have seen, and as I have seen, it seems like the negotiation process has not been the best that we've ever seen in the world. The same to also for the Ukraine conflict scenario. The negotiation process has not been the best. I mean, even the world's so-called most negotiator, I don't know if I should laugh or if, because I don't want to sound sarcastic, but, you know, Donald Trump himself also at the same UN General Assembly cited that, you know, he thought he could, you know, be the, you know, so-called chief negotiator between Russian President Putin and Ukrainian President Zelensky. And he himself said he thought it would be a straightforward discussion. It did. It was not straightforward. It was actually a more, you know, stressful engagement, as he himself said, because he literally gave us a little bit of insight in terms of how frustrating the Ukraine conflict is for him. Obviously, he's the U.S. president. Obviously, as the U.S. president, you are sort of like a guarantor of military intervention and safety in many parts of the world, and specifically in the NATO zone, which is, you know, in Western Europe. He thought it would be a straightforward thing, even after meeting Putin directly in Alaska. And obviously, as Helmut has continuously cited here on the Humran, other countries went and signed specific sections of the Rome Statute on, you know, on universal human rights and all of the other particular statutes. But Russia nor the US obviously didn't sign these, which makes it a little bit of a strategic conundrum, because you would obviously, you know, be wondering why wouldn't you sign these particular developments or these particular statutes that the rest of the world had signed and the rest of the world tries to uphold. So when we look at these particular developments, dear listeners, we have to take a look at a specific document that popped up. Now, in research, in researching for this morning's particular conversation, I obviously look at events that, you know, happened on this, on specific days in the world, events that started from something on this specific day on a specific day in the world, or a starting point on this particular day in the world. And one said particular starting point is technically born from a pre-World War I engagement. So on this day specifically, on 29 September 1917, but technically in 1923 itself, it technically starts in 1917, but in 1923 it had a little bit more of an impact. And this is ultimately the British Mandate in Palestine was established. Now, it was set in motion by the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And the British Mandate for the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine was finally approved by the Council of the League of Nations, and it came into force on this particular day in 1923. So, like I told you at the start, I thought this all started in 1945, the establishment, obviously, of Israel. Lo and behold, there technically was a engagement prior to even the Great Depression itself, which technically gave rise to all the kinds of things, the bad things that occurred during the 6 years of the Second World War. Because depending on where you were, the Second World War technically began in 1939 for some. If you were in another part of the world, the Second World War technically began in 1940. So it depends on where you were. Were you in Asia, where obviously the aggressor was Imperial Japan, or were you in Europe, where obviously the aggressor there was that large amalgamation of Germanic-speaking peoples in Europe, who obviously had the, you know, failed Austrian painter as their head of state. So as you're obviously seeing this particular scenario unfold in front of you, you're going to ask yourself the question in terms of, so there was a document, Dwight, that was established, that cited and agreed to something regarding the modern day mess that we are seeing today? Yes. Yes, there is such a document. And yes, this potentially is the document that laid the foundation for the madness that kicked off in 1945. Now, let's set the scene, dear listeners. If you try to understand specifically the pains, the aches of actually where all the particular negative impact of the establishment of this new territory, this new country in the Middle East, stems from, is technically, we all thought that it started from what the local Palestinians would call it, you know, and they have a word for it, it's known as the Nakba, since 1948, technically. That's obviously now as the British Mandate then literally came into force in that particular period. So what I mean from 1945 is obviously this is now as the discussions had started ramping up there in Europe, between the European Jewish community to technically have a homeland of their own, and specifically that they wish to see a specific territory. Now, you and I thought, because in many cases it has also been cited, the biblical reference, the biblical reference made to the modern day Israel territory that we know today, also started stemming up in the discussions, obviously, that happened in the aftermath after the Second World War. Obviously. And just to make a little bit of a, correction, the other day specifically, you know, Franz walked in on, you know, here in the studio and specifically asked me about, you know, the impact of, well, not the impact, but rather, you know, he made a George Soros-ish comment, you know, when I stood in for the unpacking the day. And, I thought the surname Soros of this gentleman, this billionaire in the US, George Soros, sounded very Greek-ish. It actually comes about that he's of Hungarian descent, but he's an American, a billionaire, obviously. And he technically is, as Franz rightly, you know, pointed towards, that he's, you know, an American Jew. I'm not stating on that particular scenario. It's just, I found it very weird in terms of, you know, you don't get many Greeks with Jewish roots. You don't find that easily. Lo and behold, technically, he is also a Holocaust survivor, or his family, because technically he was a kid that time, and his surname was technically Schwarz, which translates to black. You know, in terms of understanding his particular roots. So it was a straightforward scenario as well. But, when you view the 1948, if I can call it sort of like the major chasm or the starting block of said particular madness that reigned from 1948 until now, I call it madness, dear listeners, because specifically I'm an African, we have African issues. We have African issues. You can only feel for people. For example, I do feel for the hostages that are still being held by the Hamas group. I also feel for the, you know, the Palestinians in terms of the overall negative impact that they've experienced. The reason why I am so diplomatic in that particular stance is primarily because we have major African issues still persisting. I mean, just to give you a weird analogy. Anywhere else, supposedly, the Gen Zs are very, very, very well off. Anywhere else in the world, except Namibia and South Africa. In Namibia and South Africa, they're potentially not as well off, and I'm talking about economically well off. So that technically speaks towards the particular ongoing developmental pains that Namibia has to sort out. Once again, citing that back to our own president's particular, you know, speech at the UN General Assembly of, there are too few Namibians to be poor. Which is something that she has continuously reiterated across Namibia in any particular public engagement she attended, where she cited the same statement. There are too few Namibians to be poor. True. There's also a lot of things that you can, you know, that can be implemented to achieve that, you know, to reverse that particular state of being. Now, getting back in earnest, obviously in 1923 on this day, 29th September, or actually 28th September, just want to be sure about my particular date. We obviously saw it's technically 28. I actually jumped a day in advance, but yeah. So on 29 September specifically, that's now tomorrow, the Balfour Declaration, actually sets in motion the particular developments for the establishment of Israel in its earliest forms back then. However, as we get into what the Balfour Declaration actually was, is that the Balfour Declaration was a statement of British support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. It literally says that. And I also have the document in front of me. It was made in a letter dated on 2 November 1917 from Arthur James Balfour, who was the British Foreign Secretary at the time, to Lionel Walter Rothschild, who was the second Baron Rothschild, who was also a leader of the British Anglo-Jewish community. Now, though the precise meaning of the correspondence has been disputed between the two men, its statements were generally contradictory to both the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was a secret convention between Britain and France, and the Hussein-McMahon correspondence, which was an exchange of letters between the British High Commission in Egypt, that being Henry McMahon, and Hussein ibn Ali, the Emir of Mecca, obviously in Saudi Arabia, which in turn contradicted one another as well. Now, the Balfour Declaration obviously meant that it was issued through the continued efforts of the Chaim Weizmann and Nahum Sokolov themselves. These are two men who were both particular, you know, Jewish leaders in London. Well, the term used here in front of me is Zionist leaders. There's no way I can obviously, you know, prove another point, the counterpoint to that. And it fell short of the expectations specifically of the Zionists, who had asked for the reconstitution of Palestine as the Jewish national home. So you can obviously see it was a Eurocentric particular effort in terms of establishing how having land in another neighborhood. I actually also want to interject a little bit, guys, because I heard also of the very weird suggestion that would have come through that post-1945, there were also plans specifically with the British potentially looking at in terms of establishing Israel in Africa. There were plans, literally. There were. I'm not making a joke. I'm not lying. Now you can just think to yourself, what would have been the regional, continental nightmare of the British doing something like this? Well, here's one of the weirdest things further to compound that particular train of thought. The British have actually done this before. They have gone and established countries. And whether you are the Pan-Africanist that you wish to be in terms of, you know, abolishing all borders on the continent, in actual sense, it is the British that actually established, the British and the French that established all these borders. It is exactly them that established all the borders on the continent. Now, if they were the same guys that established these borders, and if they were the same guys specifically who established a specific Eurocentric country in the Middle East, because yes, it was them moving Europeans, who just had a different faith, they weren't Christian, to the Middle East and establishing a country there. And still today, specifically, they are the ones primarily, perpetuating whatever is happening there in the Middle East that we have become so tired of, so weary of. You have to ask yourself the question, you know, why did they start this in the first place? Why did they start this nightmare in the first place? Now, the declaration specifically stipulated that nothing, and here's where we start in inverted commas, nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. That was the Balfour Declaration. And as I said, I have the document in front of me. The document, however, said nothing of the political or national rights of the communities and did not refer to them by name. Now, this has also been the problem of post-World War I political negotiations. The British in that stage in 1923 or 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was actually written, were in a position of still defending their colonial possessions. Yeah, I actually came across a second Balfour Declaration. There's actually two of them. You just have to understand which one you might be citing. If you're citing the one of 1917, you're talking about the impacts in the Middle East one. Ultimately, that's where the first particular indications of a homeland for European, you know, people with Jews of European origin wishing to be resettled in the Middle East, are obviously seeking this. And the Balfour Declaration of 1926 technically seems like it is the precursor, sort of like legal document for the establishment of the Commonwealth. You know, that same neighborhood that I am still baffled as a Namibian as to why we're in that neighborhood. Because that neighborhood in a case or in a scenario sort of like tries, in a way, it glorifies, British colonialism. No, it literally does. It glorifies British colonialism. Which is weird. I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome, but it's the weirdest Stockholm syndrome I've ever seen in my life. I understand the United Nations because we're all on the same planet and it represents Earth and the needs of Earth, of all humans and, you know, anything indigenous to this planet. But the Commonwealth is primarily just a severely perverse club to be part of. It's literally a perversion. It literally is. Now, when you look at, there are obviously some good things, and in many cases, too many bad things, specifically the British have left us with. Literally. The downside has been their particular role in impacting, you know, all the foreign policy in the world. They are literally the guys behind the mess that created the modern day Iran, as you and I see it. They're literally behind the, obviously the modern day Israel and Palestine, mess that we still are seeing today. When I was born, there was the Palestine and Israel issue. You know, so many years later on, it's still the same issue, still unresolved, still not reaching a particular peaceful conclusion. Voila, there we go. They were behind the particular, if I can call it sort of like the negative issues between countries like India and Pakistan. Yeah, they were behind it. They were behind the Suez Canal crisis, where, once again, an Israel that they armed still till this day, was tasked with literally invading Egypt to take the Suez Canal, which is in Egypt, from Egypt. They were behind it, the British. They were. They were the ones that gave us to South Africa. Because if, just as I told you guys specifically when we looked at the, you know, the Paris Peace Conference that happened in terms of, you know, why, what were the drawbacks, and primarily we looked at the issue of the Australian Prime Minister at the time, who technically was the reason as to why the League of Nations failed from a specific principle of not recognizing every person as being of being equal. Meaning it was a problem, not just for the Australian Prime Minister's particular immigration policy of just seeking European settlers or European immigrants for Australia, but technically also seeking, becoming a problem for countries like Britain and France at the time, who both had colonial possessions. Because the moment they placed in a sentence or statement that said all humans are equal, because that's what the Japanese at the time, before the Japanese became the bad guys in the Second World War, the Japanese were technically part of the good guys in the First World War. They helped supply certain, you know, they were like a supplying nation. All the Japanese wanted, because the Japanese were invited to the conference, is that they wanted a sentence that literally said there, all humans are equal. Japan, just like us, also experienced the threat of colonialism, guys. And this happened in the 1800s and the 1700s. The Spanish and the Portuguese were obviously the longest there. That's obviously as Christianity was being, you know, perpetuated throughout. I'm talking about the ancient world, so I'm talking here from the 1500s onwards. I mean, the Spanish, the Dutch, and the Portuguese had been the longest in Asia. They had been, you know, trading and obviously establishing colonial territories there and stuff like that, getting involved with local politics in those particular neighborhoods. So, if you did not know, the port city of, is it Hiroshima? Of Hiroshima was one of the few places in terms of where foreigners technically could land during the medieval times of Japan. And so Japan has always had an issue specifically with the threat of full-on invasion and colonialism from the European, from Europeans, whether they be, you know, Europeans that came there with a notion of specifically just firstly trying to trade and then ultimately trying to influence local policy, and local politics, to even the particular, what's the threat to the 1800s, primarily after the Napoleonic Wars, where you had the threat specifically of another European threat, because at that stage, the Europeans had technically, you know, colonized China, and it influenced China to a negative, and I'm talking about Imperial China, to a negative, whereby Imperial China, and this is after the Opium Wars, the Boxer Rebellion, and all those other particular conflicts, I mean, France, all the major European countries of the time were in China, carving up China for themselves, and primarily, it was an issue. It was an issue. The Chinese still do not forget that. Literally, they still don't forget the, you know, colonialism or colonial chapter that they had to experience. And that was also the persistent threat that Japan faced. There was a specific civil war, once again, a civil war period here in the 1800s, just before 1900, where primarily, once again, the British, the French, the Americans, the Germans, by that time, it was just after they became a unified Germany, they were literally involved in many parts of that civil war of Japan. They were supplying guns. They had soldiers on the ground. They had various particular military advisors and stuff like that happening on the ground. Because it was between the modernization of Japan and the continuation of the old system of Japan. Specifically being, are you continuously going to stay feudal or are you going to try and modernize? So, just setting the scene there for you, you got to understand the vast influences that the UK had pre-1945. Well, up until 1980 at least, around the world. That's the reasons why the economist Jeffrey Sachs says the antics that you see from America today is something that they were trained with and given to by the British. The British gave it to them and taught them and trained them all these particular antics. Which is pretty true. Now, as mentioned, dear listeners, obviously, you know, giving you that massive explainer there of the background setting. The document obviously of the Balfour Declaration didn't speak anything of the political and national rights of the communities who were non-Jewish, who were already living in the specific territory itself, which we now call or identify as the Israel territory, as the nation. But obviously back then it was known as Palestine. The declaration also aroused enthusiastic hopes amongst, you know, the European Jewish community at the time, and seemed that the fulfillment of the aims of the World Zionist Organization. Now, I'm not going to jump down that particular, not that I say call it a rabbit hole, but you can obviously see how these particular influences are coming together in, if I can call it like a scenario of influencing the picture that you're seeing today, and if you're trying to make sense of the picture today. Now, the British government at the time hoped that the declaration would actually rally Jewish opinion, especially in the United States, to the side of the Allied powers against the Central Powers during the First World War. They hoped also that the settlement in Palestine of a pro-British Jewish population might help to protect the approaches to the Suez Canal. Ding ding, remember that. Remember that statement, because we did speak about the Suez Canal crisis, and that being in neighboring Egypt, and thus also to ensure a vital communication route to British colonial possessions in India. So as you can see, at the time, the British were still in the mindset specifically of being in control of their possessions. Now, before we actually step in to the next particular chapter, is that you've got to understand that how the British came about the territory of what we know as Palestine itself was because it was confiscated from a previous colonial master. That being the Ottoman Empire at the time, and that's obviously before the Ottoman Empire itself also dissolved after the First World War. And then obviously it then became the modern day Turkish Republic that we all know. So, we'll be taking a little bit of a deep dive in terms of looking at the possession of this territory known as modern-day Israel by the Ottoman Empire, and then it helps us understand specifically, you know, what that particular influence also spoke from. On that note, dear listeners, we'll be taking a short musical break, and we'll be coming back right after that.
Thank you.
Obviously bringing us back there, well, just 5 minutes before the top of the hour at 6 a.m. specifically, dear listeners, you've dapped with the sounds of Aaron Fraser, not Taylor, with the song Dime featuring, well, obviously someone collaborated with him on the song. The woman's name is actually Kanko Musa. And just before that, you heard the double take there coming through from the electronic duo known as Jungle with Cherry and Cause Your Mind, in terms of just setting us the scene there, in terms of giving us a little bit of a breather as well. Now, returning back to where we left off, I pose to you the question specifically that how the British got to be in possession of the territory known as Palestine at the time, as modern day Israel today, is that they actually took it from someone else. And when they obviously took it from someone else, this technically also makes them the new sort of like authority in the neighborhood itself. And this also specifically speaks particular volumes, because just before the break, I also told you specifically that obviously the British were also in possession of the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is, as I also told you, it was owned by the Suez Canal Company, and the company itself was technically a partnership company between the British and the French governments, because it was technically an SOE. It was technically an SOE. An SOE that generated a lot of money. Let me say this again. An SOE that generated a lot of money. And obviously when Egypt then became independent, Egypt obviously also said, hey, listen, we want this thing. It's in our country and we're not making money from it as well. We want this thing. Which technically led to the Suez Canal crisis of the 1950s, which literally involved Israel. Because Israel invaded from the north and to try and take the Suez Canal from the Egyptians, who were the rightful owners. Just, can you guys imagine these particular things that happened pre-1980? You getting involved for something you own. Well, let me rather put it this way. You getting invaded for something that's rightfully yours. Rightfully yours. It's yours. It's in your country. It's yours. It's in your country. And the thought by that time was that the French and the British thought that they could continuously hold on to this particular infrastructure without sort of like, you know, saying to the Egyptian government at the time, who became obviously independent, that, you know what, you guys can't demand any further particular benefits from this particular piece of infrastructure, which was just the wrong way to think about things specifically. Now, at the time, dear listeners, bringing you now back to the, you know, the Balfour Declaration discussion, is that the declaration was endorsed by the principal Allied powers, and it was included in the British mandate over Palestine, formally approved by the newly created League of Nations. So as you can see, the League of Nations had a few flaws, because this League of Nations literally perpetuated that the status quo be maintained. Now, I have to tell you this, guys. The American president at the time, not many people like him that much. I'm talking about historians and, you know, other particular aspects in, you know, people in history. Because he was technically an isolationist. He wanted the United States to contain or to maintain their isolationist policy, which was they don't get involved in world affairs. They don't get involved with, you know, with the affairs of the European nations, and they don't get involved specifically in, you know, in negative things, specifically like the perpetuation of colonialism even further. That at the stage before 1914, before the First World War, that's the position that the Americans had. The Americans literally said they don't want to get involved in other people's wars. Obviously, which has not been the picture, because they've gotten involved with every other particular global conflict since 1914. After that. Now, the Americans technically also, and that's not the American public, they were also, they didn't also want to be involved in the League of Nations. Even though the League of Nations was the brainchild of their president, it technically meant that the Americans were not fully, you know, participating in this particular collection of countries, because you still had the British and the French sitting there dictating things from a colonial perspective. Yep, guys. yes, we're still dealing with hangovers from 1918, 1921, 1923. You mention it, you name it. We're still dealing with these things today in 2025. Why? Well, here's the thing. In May of 1939, the British government altered its policy in a white paper, recommending that a limit of 75,000 further immigrants and an end to immigration by 1944, unless the resident Palestinian Arabs of the region consented to further immigration. Now, the Zionists at the time condemned the new policy, accusing Britain of favoring the Arabs, and that this point was made moot, meaning it was literally kicked out, by the outbreak of World War II, and that the founding of the State of Israel occurred in 1948. Now, the obvious particular scenario of who owned Palestine before, as I mentioned just before the musical break, was literally it was owned by the Ottoman Empire, by the Turks. The area that today comprises of Israel and the Palestinian territories was crafted when the Ottoman Empire fell after World War I. Now, the area occupied by the British included the Ottoman Sanjak district, that's a word for district, of Jerusalem, and the Sanjaks of Acre and Balka in the Beirut Valiyet or Governorate area. So Beirut was also part of this discussion. While the Sanjaks north of Acre were occupied by the French. Now, since the areas occupied by the British roughly coincided with the historic region of Palestine, the British adopted the name for its mandate. And that is, its governorship of the region was authorized by the League of Nations. Now, this obviously meant that you had two, from what you just heard, dear listeners, two colonial powers being present in the same neighborhood. You had the French to the north, and you had the British to the south. Which makes things weird. And all of these obviously had their own particular, you know, sort of like governance structures. You've got the province of Lebanon, you've got the Sanjak of Beirut, the Sanjak of Tripoli, and the Sanjak of Latakia, which are all like provincial elements here as outlined in the illustration in front of me. Another particularly interesting thing was that the British mandate, which is now after 1923, then started looking differently, because the British mandate also included the area east of the Jordan River. So this is a part that, just so that I get this, this looks like parts of Syria, and parts of other neighboring countries, because Iraq is not far from there. Now, the other part of the British mandate on the east of the Jordan River, now the Jordan River literally is, it's literally a border, it's a natural border, which was also called the Transjordan, because it was later on then named the Jordan River. In 1923, Great Britain, that's the UK's former name, allowed the Hashemite dynasty to administer the portion, that specific portion of land, and it granted it full independence in 1946. Now, the land west of the Jordan River remained under direct mandatory administration. So, if you're looking at a map, there's a river that borders modern-day Israel. It borders on modern-day Israel. That's what we now see as Israel. On the left of it, facing the Mediterranean Sea, that's the territories which are now obviously the disputes and the discussions of modern day, you know, the modern day global politics. And on the left, right hand side of that river, there are portions that are supposed to be, there's a major portion here because Israel today does not border onto Iraq. So technically there's a major portion that was given to Syria. There's a major portion probably given to Jordan. And yeah, specifically, and another portion probably given to another country. But to me, it predominantly looks like Jordan in its own right. However, However, this picture obviously changed after 1945. Reason being is that the land west of the Jordan remained under the mandatory administration, but this is when the British withdrew and the State of Israel was then created in 1948. Now, this particular conundrum in its own right, meaning that where you find the country Jordan today was literally also this manufactured state that the British created. Hence the reason why I told you the British have done this before. If at all, we really have to, if you are someone that is a Pan-African that is annoyed by the, you know, the construction of the, you know, of these borders and these national identities and all that, much of your annoyance has to be pointed towards the British. It's the British that caused this. In many cases, the information, the data is sometimes sketchy because the British themselves have been known to destroy colonial documents. It stems from the various issues that, you know, around the history of Kenya. The British were known for destroying documents, burning them, destroying them, anything to do with transgressions, crimes, and possible, you know, severely negative pieces of information regarding the treatment of people in, you know, where they were. They were known for destroying documents. Hence, one of the particular reasons is that it's very easy to point out the, you know, in other countries to point out certain particular things to people regarding, you know, what some colonial powers did. But the downside has been that the British have been just as bad. Even more worse, potentially. Even more worse. And then the downside was also, it also depended on the kind of politics that was present in the various territories at the time. Because in many cases, many people forget, for example, if you go look at India, that India was made up of a lot of principalities. A lot of principalities, meaning they had their own unique, I don't want to say indigenous leader, but they had their own unique sort of like a traditional authority set up. Not that the word of traditional authority is the best way to identify it, because we're talking about princes and kings and, you know, and all these particular things. So a principality, literally it was a principality. Now, the 1947 partition plan regarding the, you know, the discussion around the Balfour Declaration and what the Balfour Declaration actually feeds is that according to the United Nations Resolution 181, Israel was supposed to look like the area specifically in terms of what was allowed. Meaning, we've all seen this particular illustration that it was supposed to be sort of like this weird, checkered, land distribution setup. However, the reality today is that we obviously see that the Palestinians have been pushed out of much of these particular areas, and they technically are confined to two small areas in the broader territory itself, which is now known as modern-day Israel. Now, the area around Jerusalem would have been administered by an international regime, but the Arabs rejected the partition, and that the borders were ultimately determined by the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. And that's obviously the first time that I think it was Syria and Lebanon and Jordan had invaded Israel at that stage, because it was known as the first particular war. It was the first particular war, because it was the Syrians that actually, you know, tried to help the Palestinians at that stage. So we were saying, hey, listen, man, the situation is not right. Now, this is obviously as an Arab state west of the Jordan River was actually also never created, in this particular scenario. So what we're talking about west is obviously on the left facing the Mediterranean, not on the east. The dimension, obviously, of this also speaks towards the what happened between 1949 to 1967, because the internationally recognized borders of Israel today, which also includes the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, were established by the armistice agreements between Israel and its neighbors at the end of the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. So this particular discussion obviously meant that, you know, border sovereignty started becoming a major thing, because you also have to look at the modern day discussions coming about. Okay, I'm not telling you guys to try and, you know, digest anything that Netanyahu says today, because many academics technically don't like the rhetoric and the plan that he's putting in motion. If a guy like Netanyahu was technically in Africa, it would have been hate speech. As a leader, it would have been hate speech. This obviously makes it problematic, because you can obviously see how the world has a different view on, you know, in terms of governments during perceived war times, and governments, you know, technically in terms of war, just acting in bad faith. Now, you've got to understand here, dear listeners, that things were supposed to look different in a different way. Now, obviously, what we experienced here in Namibia, obviously through the particular governance and the particular lack, in some cases, lack of economic development in Namibia under the South African, can't say mentor, I almost said mentorship, but it was not mentorship, because technically we were treated weirdly. Yes, many people would come in and say, you know what, the human rights situation, that's, keep that discussion. We know that. I'm talking about in another scenario, in terms of if you need to look at Namibia's economic pathway, we were treated weirdly. Namibia was literally just an extraction spot. We were literally, if you can use a better word, looted. We were looted. That's the reasons also in terms of why we struggle as a country like Namibia in terms of finding our own particular industrial pathway, in terms of developing industries, a secondary industry phase and various other industry phases, because we have to achieve certain levels. We have to achieve certain particular economic goals for ourselves. Now, you can obviously see the negative influence, or sort of like the negative after effects that decisions made by the British at the League of Nations and Paris Peace Conference still has on Namibia 100 years later. 100 years later. But before we actually continue, guys, we're quickly going to take a short ad break, and we're going to come back right after this.
Get your monthly essential products for just 599 Namibian dollars at USAID. Get 10 kilograms each of Marathon White Sugar, Champion Super Maize Meal and Bokomo Fat Cook Flour. Also 5 kilos nice rice, as well as 500 grams Grande Pasta. All 5 products for only 599 Namibian dollars. You save, I save, yes we all save at USAID.
You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you. From 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. So we come back, dear listeners, there from the quick break. And yes, we're in the second half specifically of this morning's program here on My Sunday Morning Take. And obviously this is... we've reached the time frame of, you know, 6:15, this early in the morning. Obviously, I do hope that you've woken up at least with a little bit of a hot drink in your palm. Your definition of hot is up to you, please. I don't want to know what your definition would be, But as long as you've, you know, at least gotten up, stretched your legs a bit, had the opportunity of looking at, you know, what has happened, and ultimately that you've probably had a good sleep. The scenario specifically where we find ourselves is that we technically just have 45 minutes left for our discussion still, this early in the morning. Yes, if you're making your way to whatever particular, you know, pathway in life that you are heading to for this morning, what I mean by that, your destination, your, you know, if you're going to church, if you're going somewhere, if you're going to work, you obviously just remember that you've got to stay in our company in terms of obviously getting or being involved in some of the particular and unique conversations that we always bring you here live on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. Now, to continue where we left off, is that obviously the discussion that stemmed through after the 1949-1967 particular border wars between the modern-day Israel and much of its neighbors, obviously saw this emanating from an armistice, a bunch of armistice agreements that stemmed from negotiations with the neighbors of the neighbors to Israel itself. Now, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip were occupied by Jordan and by Egypt, just so that you guys know. Obviously, Jordan was that other particular established country that the British established by giving territory to the what is now known as the Kingdom of Jordan. And respectively, and in 1950, Jordan then also annexed the West Bank. So you can obviously see primarily how this particular map looked like. So it meant that under the protection of the Egyptians, Gaza Strip was, you know, under Egyptian sort of like mandate, and the West Bank was under Jordanian mandate or some sort of Jordanian assistance. However, this picture then changed greatly because it obviously saw the Six-Day War take place in 1967. If you don't know what the Six-Day War was, this is literally where the Israelis once again went and took things a bit far, and it saw the Six-Day War emanate. And this technically was where they took the Golan Heights from Syria. They went and established and literally placed the border on the Jordan River with Jordan, so that technically the, you know, if I can say, the involvement of the Jordanians in the West Bank was then cut off. And so to the same thing with the Egyptians to the south being involved in Gaza Strip in that scenario. Now, this saw, obviously, Israel occupy the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. And by 1982, the Sinai Peninsula was then returned back to Egypt in accordance with the Camp David Accords of 1979. So you can obviously technically see the negative after effects that technically came from the Balfour Declaration, is because primarily this was as the very well-rooted and very well-documented discussion of, you know, trying to carve out a country that technically has a large European resettlement program, because in many cases, many of the current particular inhabitants of the modern-day Israel that you see technically come from Europe. They're not people that were there. They were given the space by the British, and they were told, you know, you can go settle there, in 1948. The image obviously becomes even a little bit more, you know, it advances, or should I say, yeah, it technically advances, because from 1995 up until today, it's obviously the particular scenario that you are now up to speed with in terms of the engagements happening there in the Middle East specifically. Now, this is as the 1995, the Oslo Accords, or the Oslo II Accords, divided the West Bank and the Gaza Strip into areas under Palestinian administration, and the areas under Palestinian administration, but joint Israeli-Palestinian security as well, and also areas that were under complete Israeli administration and security. And in 2005, Israel then withdrew from this Gaza Strip, from the Gaza Strip entirely, although it re-entered Gaza, obviously in 2023, during the Israeli-Hamas war. Now, what we obviously see here is a discussion that is literally one based upon decisions obviously made 100 years back that obviously speaks towards lingering and continuous particular impacts that we see today. Regarding this, primarily that when the Ottomans obviously had this piece of land under their control, the Ottomans obviously were of the scenario that, you know, primarily they would still be influencing that area, obviously prior to now experiencing that they actually lost in the First World War. Now, this is obviously following Britain's declaration of war on the Ottoman Empire in November of 1914. It began to consider the future of Palestine. Now, that is just within 2 months, a memorandum was circulated to the war cabinet by a specific Zionist member in Britain, known as Herbert Samuel, proposing the support of Zionist ambitions to enlist the support of Jews in the wider war effort. Now, a committee was established in April of 1915 by the British Prime Minister at the time, H.H. Asquith, to determine their policy towards the Ottoman Empire, including Palestine. Now, Asquith, who had favored post-war reform of the Ottoman Empire, resigned in December of 1916. His replacement, David Lloyd George, this is obviously also supposedly the guy that annoyed Woodrow Wilson a lot, because him and his French counterpart, what was that guy's name? I keep forgetting the French counterpart. They were, you know, obviously pro, you know, maintaining the status quo in terms of their national interests. Obviously this being the French and British interests in other parts of the world. Now, David Lloyd George favored partition of the empire. That's now the Ottoman Empire. And the first negotiations between British and the Zionists took place in a conference on 7 February 1917 that included Mark Sykes and the Zionist leadership. Now, Mark Sykes, just sort of like to give you a background, he was technically a colonel of the British Army, and he was also an English traveler, a Conservative Party politician, because that's one of the oldest political parties in the UK, the Conservative Party. And he was also a diplomatic advisor, primarily with regard to Middle Eastern affairs at the time of the First World War. He's similar to, like, if you ever look up the character itself, the character that was played by, what was the guy's name? By the British actor, Lawrence of Arabia. If you ever looked up Lawrence of Arabia, it was actually the name given to a British intelligence officer at the time that had to, you know, conduct guerrilla war efforts, along the local Arab nomadic tribes in the Middle East against, I think it was against the Ottomans, or it was against someone else. His name actually, this particular gentleman is that it's actually a true story. If you don't know about the story of Lawrence of Arabia, because the man's name was actually Thomas Edward Lawrence, who was, you know, dispatched to the Middle East primarily, but, these particular guys were like the missionaries that we all heard of during African history. Specifically, the missionaries would write reports, they would write correspondence letters, and then these reports and correspondence letters would then find their way back to the central governments back in Europe. I mean, that's how many of the particular missionaries, specifically the German and British missionaries and traders, would write back to Germany and England. You know, in Namibia's history, pre-1900. Literally pre-1900. And if you guys do not know, what's that guy's name? Adolf Luderitz was literally commissioned by Otto, by Bismarck Otto's, by the German state at the time. He was literally commissioned to come and come and check what's going on here. To come and see, you know, what this place is. Now, as you're obviously looking at the scenario from, you know, a person like Mark Sykes, who himself was sort of like a, well, they called, at that stage, they called them travelers, because it was at that stage, you know, these were people that were literally, they would literally sort of like hold fundraising events so that they could travel the world. Obviously those things don't happen anymore today because you now have the internet and everyone can, you know, potentially in their own rights, if you can afford the plane ticket, you can buy a plane ticket and you can go there yourself and you can be a traveler. Now, subsequent discussions, obviously between the local, you know, the local enthusiasts for an establishment of the modern day Israel at the time, obviously held further subsequent discussions that led to Balfour's particular request, because on 19 June, this also included, one of the particular role players that I mentioned earlier, this Rothschild guy and Chaim Weizmann, who drafted a public declaration. Now, the further drafts were also discussed by the British cabinet during the September and October of that year of 1917. Remember, we're obviously here on looking at 29, even though today is 28 September, but 29 September of 1923 is obviously the particular day. And the, in 1917, the inputs still particularly continued with inputs from the Zionist and anti-Zionist Jews, but with no particular representation from the local population in Palestine. And right there, dear listeners, you actually get to the crux of the matter. It's primarily the concerns in terms of how affairs were dealt with back then that still persist and that still have a negative impact on life, on lives today. Lives today. By late 1917, the wider war had actually reached a stalemate with two of Britain's allies not fully engaged. The US had yet to suffer a casualty and the Russians were in the midst of their own revolution. Now, the stalemate in southern Palestine was broken by the Battle of Beersheba on 31 October of 1917. The release of the final declaration was then authorized on 31 October, and the preceding cabinet decision had referenced perceived propaganda benefits amongst the worldwide Jewish community for the Allied war effort. But once again, no one asked the local Arabs that were living in this territory that the Ottomans were occupying. No one had asked these guys, hey, what's up, guys? You know, here's my phone number. Can we have a chat later on? Establish a date, a meeting. You know, take some details. Ask your insights and inputs for this particular discussion that's happening there in London. Zero. Now, the opening words of the declaration represented the first public expression of support for Zionism by a major political power. And it literally reads, if I read it to you guys, because the document is, you know, in a PDF format right here in front of me. It says, Dear Lord Rothschild, it's dated 2nd November 1917 from the Foreign Office. It starts off, Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. In the particular quotes that open up, it says, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. End of declaration. And it literally then ends off by saying, I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Signed. Now, as you can clearly see there, like we started off with the discussion, it has no input specifically from the people that are already living in the territory. neither does it also clearly define the religious and, you know, low and personal and the human rights status of the groups that already also live in the territory. Meaning it makes things tricky. Because technically this meant that they never had a say in their own pathway. The Balfour Declaration, dear listeners, is literally the reason to the mess we sit with as a world today. Because specifically, in 1945, the British were there. The British were in the Middle East. They had soldiers on the boots on the ground. 1945. They had soldiers there. And I couldn't understand. It was known as the British Palestine. It was known as British Palestine. I was like, what? Because the British were also in Lebanon, modern-day Lebanon, which is to the north of Israel. That whole area was like one neighborhood situation there. The British were also there. Because the British were also in Cyprus, which is right across Israel and Lebanon today. It's a massive island nation just across them. The British were also in Malta, because those are all naval bases that the British had owned, obviously since the Napoleonic Wars, because they decided, you know what, let's dominate the Mediterranean area, primarily because at that stage, you know, trade was being impacted. The British were there. The British had defensive treaties with countries like Greece and Portugal. They obviously had their own particular sort of like naval base at Gibraltar. The British obviously had, what was the other country's name? That they also had a particular defensive treaty with in the Middle East, in that neighborhood of the Mediterranean Sea. But they were there. Why were they there? Obviously built from, you know, the same particular foreign policy initiatives that were based on, you know, using, if you've got the soldiers, use your might, you know, to get your way. And obviously having the presence there is obviously that you create a safe particular sort of like a zone for your interests. And your interests can be economic interests in many parts, in most parts. Now, as laid out, dear listeners, obviously the talking point from the Balfour Declaration makes things weird. Now, obviously, this guy, Arthur Balfour, is no longer alive. He's obviously no longer alive. And so to also the other particular stakeholders in this piece of communication or this document itself are also no longer alive. So this makes things tricky because the discussion or the platform of plausible deniability easily pops up, meaning the UK can literally say, hey, listen, that was a different time. We don't identify anymore as Great Britain. We now identify as the UK. Yeah. They will literally tell you that. I literally heard that argument 2 years back. Primarily being, you have to ask, and if you go and search for this particular explainer on the internet, and you ask, what's the difference between Great Britain and United Kingdom? The Great Britain name was used. Okay, you see the name Great Britain a lot, specifically in the Olympics. And yeah, in the Olympic scenario. The name is used because under the IOC, you know, the IOC doesn't recognize Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. So specifically, you know, they all would count as one territory. So they have to show up with the Union Jack, which is that other flag that is also used by the British. The Union Jack is the one with the multiple crosses, you know, with the left, right, and the two diagonals crossing through. So when they have to use that particular flag, then they become known as the United Kingdom. The Great Britain scenario, if you go look it up, in terms of what's the difference between the UK and Great Britain, is that the Great Britain scenario was when they were proud of their colonial possessions. The UK name that is used today is to say, hey, listen, we are, you know, we we have this new particular international viewpoint of that we are also, you know, trying to be friends with as many countries as possible. However, we are in charge of a weird club that literally encompasses the whole world. The whole world. There was a, to factor in, you know, into the perversion of the Commonwealth Club. Yes, guys, it is a perversion. I mean, if you love Stockholm Syndrome, then you join clubs there where your previous abuser or your previous, you know, sort of like colonizer was part of. That is something that is not, I mean, that takes international relations to the weirdest heights I've ever seen. To the weirdest heights. To the weirdest heights. Without restitution. Okay. Restitution obviously cannot take place. Restitution can only take place in commercial disputes. Without, you know, some form of reparations. And the British loved that discussion of reparations. They were proponents of it. They loved taking territories from the Ottomans and from the Germans. But yeah, obviously it makes the conversation, you know, that more interesting. That's primarily why we've got, you know, the political leaders in place. That's their jobs. That's only if they know their histories. And obviously know how and to negotiate. But yeah. So the conversation, at the time also saw, the interesting discussions obviously pop up regarding, you know, things that were happening around the world. The reason why I said, if you look up the two descriptions of the UK and Great Britain, you obviously have to look for, you know, what were the two particular views on the two names that existed. Now, the weirdest scenario right now, dear listeners, is that obviously we've now seen all the noise, we've heard all the noise coming through from the UN General Assembly this past week. It literally played out as I suspected it would. I did not publicly make aware my position in terms of what would be envisaged, but I had a feeling. The same particular two issues would once again reign on the global agenda at the UN General Assembly level. The same two particular issues would be championed by the Global South countries, which is climate change and putting an end to the two major conflicts that are literally disrupting global trade and global cooperation, which is the Ukraine conflict and the, you know, Gaza or the Hamas-Israeli war, as it is known. And, you know, that people literally, that these particular stakeholders in these particular two war scenarios have to literally achieve peace. I just summarized it up for you because I had an overwhelmingly convincing gut feeling that this is literally going to be the agenda from the Global South. It will be the agenda, and it was the agenda. So, literally, dear listeners, just citing to you there the particular developments that obviously came through there of the Balfour Declaration. Now, we'll quickly be stepping into a short musical break. After that musical break will be coming up. It probably would bring us close to the last 10 minutes of this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take. Currently, right now, we still have like a good 20 minutes left. However, quickly taking the two musical breaks. We'll be right back. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Now there's a
Listeners coming through there with the sounds from Simply Red with Do the Right Thing. I almost said Do the Right Thing, but then I remembered a old Russell, what was the guy's name? Russell Peters joke in terms of where he was continuously haunted by a salesperson who kept telling him do the right thing, and it led to questioning his masculinity in other particular directions of life, which made it sound comical, but in many cases you go like, yeah, net. In many cases, you sometimes get unexpected low blows happening around the corners or at, you know, every particular time of life. However, here on my Sunday morning take. Obviously, this leaves us with a good 8 minutes still in terms of saying, well, in one part saying our goodbyes, in another part also summarizing our discussions, as well as also taking in the last particular, if I could call it like the musical break at that time. But just to sort of like get into where we left off with the Balfour Declaration's influence on the modern day, international scene, if I can call it that, is that we sit with a lot of baggage. This is a term that obviously came up from the 90s and the 2000s. When they say someone has got a lot of baggage, we're talking about people with unresolved issues, usually in those particular scenarios, and they have impact on future relations with other people or future people that they meet. This could be friends or in other scenarios, you know, potential partners and stuff like that. Now, this you can obviously see is all the same, also the same particular scenario being that there's unresolved issues that stems from poorly designed season, or not poorly designed even, if you just call it what it is that it looks like flawed decision making from the get-go, that unfortunately those responsible are no longer there to ultimately try and remedy the situation. Now, yes, the Balfour Declaration was obviously driven by a lobby group, they usually call it like interest groups, by a lobby group, obviously back then, who had a specific interest in achieving a specific goal. This makes things weird because primarily you can literally see how far that went. This has obviously caused much consternation and issues for us in the Global South, because we're now sitting with an unresolved conflict that for 80 years, or close to 80 years. Yes, it's close to 80 years now. It's literally like 3 years shy of the UN General Assembly's 80th birthday, because the UN was literally born in, I think, 1945 to be exact. So if the actual Nakba started in 1948, you know, it makes things weird. In terms of seeing how this actually pops up, creeps up in terms of the discussion. Reason being, the popping up and the creeping up mechanism is based upon, you always see a flare up of violence, and that has been the single most common denominator in the lifespan of the modern day Israel we know today. It has just been violence left, right, and center. You don't see any particular resolutions coming through or anything being resolved. You don't see any particular lasting peace deals. You don't see any particular sort of like peaceful coexistence mechanisms being implemented. All you primarily just see is violence and destruction. Violence and destruction. Well, on that particular note, dear listeners, obviously, once again, wishing you a good morning. If you've just woken up, hope that you at least have access to a beverage of some sort. I don't want to know what your particular preferred poison would be when you wake up in the mornings, but as long as you've got something that is sort of like giving you the life or the spice to be awake. And once again, wishing you all a fabulous Sunday in our company, Eagle FM. Obviously, as you're going to progress throughout the rest of our programming, which we'll bring to you after 7 a.m. On that note, we'll take a last sort of like ending musical break to sort of like usher us into the end of our morning session here on your number one talk radio station, that being on my Sunday morning take, but also to introduce the next programming to come on after 7 a.m.